Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bad chapters in U.S. economic history echoing with a vengeance these days. The mortgage industry shaking with talk of a rescue like it's the 1980s S&L bad times. A bank collapse and customers lining up yesterday like it's 1929. And an energy crisis that can feel like a 70s show rerun. But we're in our own pickle now. How much worse does it get today? We'll ask Martin Feldstein, one of the most prominent economists of our time, from Reagan days to the Bush tax cut he helped create the world we live in. We'll ask about the way ahead. This hour on Point, Martin Feldstein on the U.S. economy. Martin Feldstein, economics professor at Harvard University, joins me from New York. He's taught and advised generations of economists at Harvard, including big players on recent and current White House teams. He was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Reagan. For nearly 30 years, he was president of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which makes the call on whether or not the U.S. is in recession. He just left that post. But still, when he speaks, markets and power brokers listen. He's a longtime advocate of supply-side economics, known as the father of the George W. Bush tax cuts. He was on the short list to replace Alan Greenspan as chair at the Federal Reserve. Full disclosure, he's currently a corporate director for giants AIG and Eli Lilly. If this is an economic moment for the history books, there are few who would be more interesting to hear from right now. Professor Feldstein, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Thanks very much for being with us. March, mid-March this year in Florida, you said that the U.S. may already be, at that time, be slipping into a deep recession, could be the most serious since World War II. You said the situation is bad. This is in March. It's bad. It's getting worse. And the risks are that the situation could be very bad. Now it's mid-July. Where are we headed, Professor Feldstein?
I think we are still sliding into that recession, and we may get a little break if the consumers respond to the tax rebate, although, frankly, it doesn't look like they're doing that. So I think we are sliding into a recession.
A recession?
I think everything that's happening in the credit markets and housing confirms that this could be much worse than the last several recessions.
What are the signs that have you worried that it may be worse than recent recessions, maybe the worst since World War II?
Well, if you look at the last few recessions, they were quite short. They lasted less than a year. They were brought about because the Federal Reserve, raised interest rates to deal with incipient inflation. And when the Fed felt it had done that, it brought down rates, and the economy bounced back. Well, the Fed has cut rates dramatically. We're certainly not seeing any bounce back. And that's because this recession was caused by what's happening in the housing markets. It wasn't caused by specifically by Federal Reserve tightening. So it is the fact that the Fed doesn't have the power to turn this around the way it did in the past that could cause this to be much worse.
Can you remember a time when the Fed was as powerless then than it is right now? And what does it mean if the Fed doesn't have the capacity that we're all accustomed to kind of get in here, you know, jiggle the knobs and turn things around?
Well, for a while, I think it meant that we needed to use a fiscal stimulus, a tax stimulus, and so I supported the tax rebates, the checks that went out last month and that are going out and that went out in May as well. But frankly, it doesn't seem to have worked nearly as well as those of us who supported it were hoping. Yes, the checks went out, about $100 billion, and yet, most of that money simply got used to build up bank accounts for future rainy days rather than being spent. So it got saved, and that doesn't help to create the demand we need to move this economy back on track.
So what might we be looking at here? You know, on Wall Street, people have been talking in quite apocalyptic terms. People throw around the word depression. You said worse since World War II. That doesn't go back to the 30s. What's on the table here, Martin Feldstein? How bad could this be?
We don't really know. What we know is that house prices are the key driver in all of this. It's because house prices are falling that the Freddie and Fannie got in trouble. It's because house prices are falling that IndyMac had to shut its doors. Mm-hmm. It's because house prices are falling that consumers are feeling depressed. We haven't seen the kind of levels of consumer concern, of consumer expectations for, well, since they began doing these series 30 years ago. So I think the key uncertainty and the key driver in the problem that we're looking at is what is happening to house prices and therefore to consumers' confidence and consumers' wealth.
We all know that there was a bubble in housing. Prices got driven way up, but how far do they fall? And is there some way to intervene to stop that fall?
Well,
should we intervene? You're the free market guy.
You're absolutely right that there was a bubble. House prices rose in the first part of this decade by something like 60% relative to incomes or rents or other measures of what house prices should have done. So it was a tremendous bubble, driven in part by the Federal Reserve's excessively easy monetary policy in the beginning of the decade. Well, a bubble like that has to burst at some point, and it did break in the middle of 2006 and started coming down. It's come down about 20%. House prices are down from the peak about 20%. In just the last 12 months, house prices across the country have fallen about 15%. But the correction is not over, and the housing experts say that just to get back to a normal level, there's another 15% fall in house prices that has to happen.
All right. If we have another 15% fall, let's say that's a lot. That's a lot more. But let's say that's what we get. What does that mean? Do you anticipate more banks closing their doors, more photographs on the front page of the newspaper and web of depositors lining up at the front door to pull it out?
Well, there will be more banks closing their doors. Depositors, of course, have insured deposits up to $100,000, but many depositors, somehow or other, have accumulated more than that in bank deposits,
yep,
single banks, and so to that extent, they are rightly nervous. And in any case, nobody wants to have a deposit in a bank that fails. Even though you're insured by the federal government, the money doesn't come out the next day. It's a more complicated process. So I think bank failures, yes, we'll see more of those. And the real problem is that although it will take another 15% fall in house values just to get us back to what could be a sustainable level, there's no reason why it'll stop there. Just as the house prices overshot on the way up, the risk is, and that's what it is, I'm not predicting that it's sure to happen, but it's the risk that I think hangs over the credit markets and that keeps me up, and that is the risk is that house prices won't just fall another 15%, but will keep falling beyond that as foreclosures put more property onto the market and lead to ever downward pressure on house prices.
That's a recipe for a pretty dark scenario. What would that look like? If they overshot on the way up, if they overshoot your projection on the way down, if housing prices lose more than another 15%, if they lose another 30%, or who knows, more than that, where do we go here?
It is not a pretty scene. It is not a pretty scene. I mean, one of the things that drives it is that during the boom years, during the early part of the decade, individuals took out mortgages with very high loan-to-value ratios.
Mm-hmm.
So an individual, instead of putting down 20%, might put down 5%, or in some cases, zero. And the creditors were willing to lend them that money because they thought, well, house prices are rising so fast, soon the individual will have significant equity in that home. Well, that worked for a while, as long as house prices were rising. But then when house prices have started to come down over the last 2 years, that's gone into reverse, and what we now see is roughly 20% of all mortgages, about 10 million homes, now have negative equity. That means that the individuals owe more on their mortgages than the value of the house.
Have you ever seen a time of challenge like this in your long and storied career as an economist, Martin Feldstein?
I have not. I think the combination of problems that we're facing is unprecedented, and the extent to which our financial markets are dysfunctional is also unprecedented in my experience of about three decades of being a careful observer and a participant in those markets.
Scares the daylights out of me to hear you say that. Does it scare the daylights out of you?
It does. It does. I think it is a very serious problem, and although the Fed has tried to do what it can, lowering interest rates dramatically, Congress and the administration did what I and others advised, a substantial tax cut to try to get people spending some more. It hasn't worked. And the danger is that the house price shrinking will continue to pull us down and pull down the financial institutions.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with big-time economist Martin Feldstein about the tough spot we're in economically, how we got here, and what comes next. He was there at the elbow of Ronald Reagan. He advised George W. Bush on his way into the White House, advised him on the tax cuts, educated, it seems, you know, half the high-powered economists in the country right now. Professor Feldstein, given your sort of opening description of where we are and where things stand, are we at risk of not just that recession everyone's been talking about, but a depression? Is that a silly question in economics terms or not?
It doesn't have a technical meaning. Recession means that the economy is contracting, that output and employment are declining. But we don't have a scientific description that at some point makes a recession a depression.
But you know what, when you see it, are we at risk of what we've seen?
I think we are at risk of something much deeper and longer than the last several recessions, which last couple of recessions lasted less than a year, from the time the economy started down till the time it turned around and started back up again. Unemployment went up about 2 percentage points. The risk is that this could last longer, go deeper, create more unemployment.
You've pointed at housing, and we'll look at what might be done on that front maybe to help turn that around. But what other big factors nationally or globally do you see at work here, Martin Feldstein?
Well, one of the things that is helping us and that is keeping the economy stronger than it otherwise would be is the more competitive dollar. The fact that the dollar has come down relative to the euro, relative to the Japanese yen, relative to the Chinese renminbi has improved our exports substantially to the rest of the world and has reduced our appetite for non-oil imports from the rest of the world. So that's giving a boost to producers in the United States, both in exporting and also in substituting for products that would otherwise come from elsewhere. So that's a help. But there's a danger that as the rest of the world begins to slow down, and we're seeing that quite clearly in Europe, as the rest of the world begins to slow down, their appetite for U.S. exports will also decline, and we won't see as much of a boost coming from that source.
So what does that combination, housing on the one hand, maybe softening demand globally for the engine that might have pulled us out of this, what does that mean about duration for the slowdown, recession, whatever it is that you see us headed into?
Until the credit markets become capable of providing more credit, it's hard to see what turns this around. That is, there are a lot of businesses out there that can't get credit today, not the very big, strong companies that have lots of internal earnings and don't need to go to the credit market. But there are a lot of small and medium-sized businesses that can't get credit. And until the banks and the credit markets more generally are capable of providing that credit, we're not going to see the increases in business investment that will help to turn this economy around. I think there's another thing, and that is consumers have been shrinking their saving rate. We have been spending more as a nation than the incomes that we have. That's been a process that has accumulated over the last 10 years, but in the last few years, we've actually come to a point where, as a nation, we are households are saving less, period. That is, the saving of the savers is less than the dissaving of the dissavers, so our overall saving rate is actually negative. Well, that can't go on. But it means that as the economy recovers, as people have more incomes, they're going to want to build up their savings more. Mm-hmm. And we saw them do that in response to the tax rebates. That, in turn, means that whatever recovery begins is going to take a longer time and is going to be slower because the money will not be spent as fast as it would have been in the past. People are going to be trying to rebuild their lost wealth.
Which means less of a consumer boost to the economy if and when it might kick in.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Martin Feldstein, I wonder so many things. One, I wonder if you thank the Lord Almighty you weren't named chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Poor Ben Bernanke testifying today, that's not an easy spot to be in. But I also wonder if this has led you to any self-reflection about the economic framework you've been promoting and really building for decades here. I mean, in some ways, we do live in the world that you built, that kind of got...
Well, I think I have no feelings of guilt about that. I mean, the things that I have emphasized, I think, have been helpful. That is, a more competitive dollar, stronger incentives for business investment, lower tax rates. I think we got into this problem because of what happened to housing in the early part of this decade, when, remember, interest rates came down dramatically. The Fed was charging only 1% to banks for overnight credit and was promising to keep rates low. Well, that drove down mortgage rates, and those low mortgage rates pushed up house prices. And how could you pass up the temptation to buy or to trade up your house when house prices were rising at 10% and you could borrow at 5%? So millions of Americans took advantage of that. Some of them took advantage of teaser rate loans that made it even more seemingly attractive. And that ultimately came to an end. House prices beginning to come down. So it's not that there's something fundamentally wrong with the economy. The economy is basically a strong economy. Markets work well. People have incentives. But you only need one serious flaw to create the kind of problem that we have. And that flaw was allowing house prices to move up so dramatically. And at the same time, allowing people to borrow against it so that loan-to-value ratios have now, as I said a couple of minutes ago, have now been pushed over 100% for many homeowners.
But maybe we've got, I mean, there's one flaw, but maybe there's a symphony going on here. I mean, the credit crunch appears to be in part because of some of the poor risk management and wild financial structures that got going here. You've been a big proponent of deregulation. I mean, I ask about it not for guilt or self-flagellation, but we're going to have to build a policy to get back out of this, and we don't want to do this again.
No, if you had asked me 5 years ago, do I think that giving the capital markets more scope would be a good thing, I would have said yes. But it wasn't an issue that I was particularly involved in. Yet I think we do see that there was inadequate supervision, particularly of the banks, by the Fed, by the controller of the currency, by the state bankers. They allowed them to hold assets of really poor quality. They allowed them to have inadequate capital, and now we're paying the price in the form of banks and the credit market more generally being in serious trouble.
But we had on George Soros last week. He was talking about where things stand right now, and of course he's got his own theories. You may not share them at all, but he said what's been revealed here are the limits of the wisdom of the markets. I mean, that was kind of a market impulse that let that moved out into all this wild frontier on lending and credit, and it's coming back to bite us now. You know, if you had it to do over again, would you crank down the markets über alles message of the Feldstein years or not?
No, I don't think I would change the basic message, but I would certainly say if we've got an institution that's got, as the banks do, that has federally insured deposits, then there has to be reliable supervision. Now, the Fed, the controller of the currency, and the state banking supervisors are supposed to do that. So we don't have an unregulated market in banks. There's supposed to be serious supervision. And we were told by these supervisors over the last 7 years, well, the good thing is that the banks now have plenty of capital.
Mm-hmm.
What they forgot was that there were these off-balance sheet, literally trillions of dollars, against which they weren't holding capital. And similarly, we were told that, unlike the time in the early 1980s, when the banks were holding less developed country debt, Now they had good, solid assets. Well, again, we now see that the supervisors were not doing their job. So I would say an economy like ours does need good supervision, and that the supervisors have been lax over the last several years in allowing this accumulation of poor assets and inadequate capital in the banking sector.
Is that part of an economic ethos, a kind of theoretical framework that you helped create, that lax oversight regulation?
No, I think, you know, we, in some sense, we all trusted the statements of the Federal Reserve and the controller of the currency and others that they were doing their job. That is their job, to supervise the banks. And they weren't doing it adequately. I think it comes down to, simply to that. And similarly, the low interest rates in the beginning of the decade that produced this bubble in house prices, the Fed should have seen what was happening to house prices. That wasn't a secret. And they, instead of focusing on the risk of deflation, they should have been aware of what was happening to house prices as they set monetary policy. Now, that's been a very controversial issue among economists. Should the Fed, when it thinks about inflation and recession, should it look at asset prices at all? And I think we've learned a good lesson from this. I don't think I had a strong view one way or the other. Alan Greenspan did have a strong view. He said, we're not smart enough to deal with asset prices. We just have to let that happen. Well, I think that turned out, in retrospect, to have been a mistake. But I think the economics profession now has probably learned from this experience that the Federal Reserve not only has to look at what's happening to the prices of the goods and services that we buy and consume, but also has to look at the prices of assets like houses, particularly houses, because of the very leveraged nature of investment and the fact that it spreads throughout the entire economy.
Let's take a call from Judy in Arlington, Massachusetts. Judy, you're on the air with Professor Feldstein.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I want to be representing the boots-on-the-ground consumer who hears what he's saying with all due respect and feel that the consumer is being blamed for a lot of it. We're being blamed because we don't spend enough money. The thing that prompted me to call today was when he said we got our tax rebates and we put them away for our rainy day fund. Nobody I know, and I'm middle class, upper middle class, by the way, nobody I know can do that. Everyone is paying off their huge credit card debt that we have been told to buy things by the government to be patriotic circa 9/11. So here we are, buy, 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 help the economy. You buy your stuff, then you get in debt. The housing thing, don't get me started, is so these people were preyed upon to buy houses. I'm lucky. I'm not in having problems with money, except I have credit card debt I can't pay down. So this is, you know what, the economists, if they would go and have focus groups of real humans, none of those people, I guarantee you, have problems paying their bills every month. And nobody they know does either, a la Phil Graham saying it's a mental recession. I'm not poor, but me and everybody below me, I can only imagine that 90% of Americans are here would hear this and say, we're supposed to go out and buy more stuff and add to our credit card debt. I'm really sorry I'm sounding so upset, but...
No, Judy, we've got it loud and clear, and I appreciate you're just laying it out there. Let's hear from Martin Feldstein. I mean, there's the human face in response. What do you say?
I think what Judy is telling us is what a lot of people feel correctly, that this is the time, if they've got that check that has come from Washington, to use it to pay down some of their credit card debt. Now, when you borrow, it's the opposite of saving. When you pay down your debt, that's a kind of saving. So when I said people are saving, I should have defined it to say they're either adding to their bank balance or they're paying down some of their debt. And so I think what Judy is doing is what it looks like most Americans are doing with these checks. They're using them to pay down their debts rather than going out and spending. And certainly nobody would blame them for doing that. It's just that when that legislation was passed, it was hoped that that would stimulate spending because that would keep the economy going, and also that somehow passing it would improve consumer confidence. But consumer confidence has tanked. So I think those of us who advocated that tax cut, I think the record may eventually show we'd still need a few more months to see what's happened, but I think the record may eventually show we got it wrong. That
which tax cut, Martin Feldstein? Do you mean the one just recently?
The one that was passed earlier this year. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what about the one earlier in the Bush administration?
Well, that was very different. I mean, the
more than
permanent
one.
Reduction in rates provides incentives, changes savings and investment behavior in the long run. But and so its purpose was not a short-run stimulus of the sort that was intended by this recent tax rebate. So the tax rebate, I think, was a good idea that failed. But I shouldn't say that unequivocally. We still need a few more months to see whether it has added significantly to data to spending. But in May and June, alas, it doesn't look like it's had that much of an impact.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Uber economist Martin Feldstein about the tough spot we're in economically right now, how we got here, and what comes next. President Bush, speaking this morning at a press conference in Washington, said, we've got some rough times right now, but things will be okay.
Bottom line is this. We're going through a tough time. But our economy has continued growing. Consumers are spending. Businesses are investing. Exports continue increasing. And American productivity remains strong. We can have confidence in the long-term foundation of our economy, and I believe we will come through this challenge stronger than ever before.
Martin Feldstein joins us from New York. Professor Feldstein, what do you make of that characterization right there by the president today? Is that the way you would describe our economy and our prospects?
I would describe our prospects in the long term, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, in very positive terms, because I think the fundamentals in the U.S. are very good. But I think before we get there, we're going through a little fast. I think we're seeing something very serious. Let me take you back to the issue of house price declines, because
yes.
I think that's so central, and it's central to consumer confidence and consumer spending and to the health of the banks. I think there is something that can be done. Nothing to stop the 15% further decline that we need just to get back to a normal level, to undo the bubble. But the worry, in my mind, is going beyond that. And I've proposed something. I've discussed it with folks in Washington.
Hmm.
Let me describe it.
Yes, please.
One of the reasons why house prices are likely to overshoot is that once you have negative equity, once you owe more on your house than the house is worth,
mm-hmm.
there's a temptation to walk away, to send in the keys and say to the bank, it's your problem now. I'm going to go rent an apartment someplace.
Mm-hmm.
We've got 20% of all people with mortgages are now in that position. They owe more than the house is worth. And a year from now, if we don't do something about it, it'll be 40%. So it's an enormous problem. And as a result of those excess debts, of those high loan-to-value ratios, we're seeing widespread defaults, foreclosures are at record highs and are increasing very, very rapidly. So somehow we've got to stop this temptation for individuals to default on their mortgages.
You've made a proposal on how to do that. What would you do?
Okay, so the proposal is this. The federal government would offer individuals, all individuals who have mortgages,
mm-hmm.
would offer them an opportunity to substitute a loan from the government for part of their mortgage. The loan from the government would carry a lower interest rate than the interest rate they're paying on the mortgage. That's what would make it attractive.
And how much of the mortgage might it cover?
I would do 20% of the mortgage up to some dollar limit,
okay,
like $80,000.
Mm-hmm.
So if you now have a mortgage that is 90% of the value of your home, there's a good chance that a year from now you're going to have negative equity,
mm-hmm.
that loan is going to be worth more than 100% of the value of your home because your home price is falling. With this mortgage replacement loan idea, the government would take that loan down from today's 90% to only 80% of that 90%,
mm-hmm.
in other words, down to 72%. Well, then there's a very, very unlikely chance that you will actually find yourself with negative equity. And the loan to the government would be a loan that you absolutely had to pay. You couldn't get out of it by defaulting on your mortgage.
In other words, no walking away from that one.
No walking away from that one. So what we would do is we would substitute a situation in which more and more people are going to have this incentive to walk away. We would substitute for that a situation in which people's monthly mortgage payments were a bit lower, but they no longer had the incentive to walk away, and that, I think, would stabilize house prices. Not at today's level, but would stop this risk of substantial overshooting in a downward direction.
As far as I know, the U.S. government has never done something like that before. We'd be in new territory there, wouldn't we?
We'd be new territory, but as we've seen in the last couple of months, the U.S. government is into lots of new territory, opening up the Fed lending to non-banks, lending for longer periods of time and against different kinds of collateral, making it clear that the federal government stands firmly behind Freddie and Fannie. So, yes, this would be new, but I think the potential for the downward spiral of house prices is such that it's something that really deserves to be done.
What do you make of the fact that after this long period of market economics sort of ruling the roost, whether it was Republicans or Bill Clinton for that matter, we've now got government in up to its elbows with Bear Stearns and what you're proposing here and the open window by the Fed and maybe taking equity and Fannie and Freddie? What do you make of that, Martin Feldstein?
Well, I think there's no question that the Freddie and Fannie shows that after years of inadequate supervision, inadequate regulation, of essentially allowing Freddie and Fannie to to grow like wildfire. The federal government has no choice but to step in and do the things that you just described. Ultimately, and after we get through the current crisis, we should be thinking about shrinking Fannie and Freddie. We should have been thinking about that 10 years ago. If we had done that then, as many people called for, we would not have had this same bubble in house prices.
Let's take a call from Charlotte, North Carolina, and Kevin. Kevin, you're on the air with Martin Feldstein.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
In your proposal, sir, about the government providing cash to help underwrite people's loans, I'm confused what the difference between that and just printing money and giving it to people is, and what the long-term prospects on inflation that creates.
Okay, good question. This money would not go, if you took up this mortgage replacement loan, the money would go to the bank or other creditors who hold your mortgage. And they, in turn, would turn over that piece of your mortgage to the government. So it would not be a creation of new money. It would simply be a substitution of your IOU to the government for your IOU to that bank or other creditor.
What about the inflation risk we may be looking at now, though? We've certainly seen it in commodities, in food. I mean, we all know what oil is doing. How do you now gauge inflation risk, even as we look at this slow growth, maybe negative, staring us in the face?
Well, it is worrying, and yet I think that the combination of a weak economy and the fact that the source of this inflation is coming from oil and food going up 100% in the last year, it makes me feel that the inflation rate, the overall CPI inflation rate, is likely to come down over the next 12 months. I think that's the bet that the Federal Reserve is also making, that this combination of an inevitable slowdown in the prices that are driving the inflation, oil and food, and the lack of a second round pass through in the form of higher wages. That's the key thing that will stop this from becoming an inflation spiral of the sort that we lived with in the 1970s. Doesn't happen.
Mm.
If wages start to rise in response to these higher prices, then we're in very serious inflation trouble.
Let's take a call from North Augusta, South Carolina, and Diana. Diana, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question, and I realize the economic models are changing so rapidly, and everything seems to be so connected and so complicated. But my question is, so much emphasis and time is being looking at the mortgage interest. But to piggyback the last caller two callers ago, is why isn't anything really being discussed about what to do to lower the interest on credit cards? Because so many consumers seem to be drowning and paying off those credit cards, and they can never pay them off. They can't buy real goods to spur the economy. And I'm just curious, why isn't more discussions being put on that, where that seemed like that could be really an area that would help the economy?
Diana, let us put it to the economist. Martin Feldstein, what about Diana's suggestion? Lower those interest rates. The banks won't want it, but what about it? And what about Barack Obama's warning that the credit card debt is the next, you know, problem that may blow up in our faces?
Well, the reason that interest rates on credit cards are so high is that default rates on credit are also very high. So there's nothing that the government can do to turn that around. So I'm afraid that we're going to continue to see high interest rates on credit cards. Indeed, even though the Fed has lowered interest rates dramatically, that has not had the effect of bringing down rates on credit cards, and it's not had the effect of bringing down rates on mortgages. So I'm afraid that is something that is going to be a problem, and that households are going to have to pay down that debt if they want to reduce
reduce that burden.
And what about Senator Obama's warning that the next credit crunch may roll out of the credit card world?
Well, there's no doubt that what started as a subprime mortgage problem has now spread to a wide range of asset classes. I think that the mortgage market is the key one because it is so large and it is driven by what's happening to house prices. But in addition to that, we're seeing it in credit cards, we're seeing it in auto loans, we're seeing it in student loans, we're seeing it in commercial loans to businesses, builders, realtors. So it is a very general problem, and as the economy weakens and as profits come down, we're going to see more of that.
You've recently signed on with a couple of 300 other economists to John McCain's economic program. You're describing pretty towering economic challenges in front of us. They come out of an era where, you know, Feldstein, Reagan, Bush, and maybe McCain economics have pretty much been the order of the day. Why are you signing up with the McCain push on the economy instead of, let's say, the Obama?
Well, with respect to McCain's policies and Obama's policies, neither of them really has put forward a proposal to deal with these crises, to deal with Freddie and Fannie, to deal with the problems of the housing market. Those short-run problems are unfortunately not being addressed by either candidate. But I like the longer-term policies that John McCain stands for. That is for free trade, for lower taxes, and I don't like the protectionist talk that I heard from Obama. I don't like the idea of substantial increases in tax rates that he's talked about. I think those things would hurt the economy in the longer run.
Let's get one more call from Frank in Arlington, Massachusetts. Frank, you're on the air with Martin Feldstein.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. Yeah. I just wanted to see if your Uber economist sees any relationship between the policies of the Fed and when he came into office and Reagan came into office in the 80s, the national debt was approximately $1 trillion. It is now $10 trillion and rising rather quickly. If the economy has expanded, yes, and it can also contract, as we're seeing. Mm-hmm. Now, the national debt is not going to contract. I wonder if he sees any the effect of the Fed policy has been to make rich people richer, in my opinion, and the taking from the poor people. I'll just listen to the response up here.
The Federal Reserve doesn't have much to do, in fact, has basically nothing to do with the size of the national debt. The national debt grows because the government spends more than it collects in taxes.
But Professor, take Frank's broader point, if you would. It doesn't all come back to the Fed, but a lot of it does come back to government policy.
Absolutely. And the basic policy that has happened almost every year in my lifetime has been that the government has spent more money than it's collected in taxes. When you spend more than you collect in taxes as a government, you have to borrow that money, and those borrowings are the national debt.
But you've pushed for tax cuts throughout that.
You've
pushed for tax cuts throughout that. Has any of this changed your view on that at all? And what about Frank's concern about concentration of wealth when a lot of the middle class and below are hurting now?
I've pushed for tax cuts, but I've also pushed for reductions in government spending.
Mm-hmm.
And a strong advocate of moving toward balanced budgets.
But you see the bottom line in that calculation right now, as Frank says, and everybody knows, that the debt has only grown.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last thing.
Just that the debt has only grown in spite of that.
I agree with that. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying to bring spending under control. And that, again, is something that John McCain has done over the years. He has voted against popular programs. And indeed, as he campaigns now and people ask him, well, do you like this or that program that will help me? He says, well, my friend, I'm sorry, I can't promise you that I would do that. I have voted against it in the past because I don't think it's a good use of the taxpayers' money. And we need somebody who will stand up for that rather than somebody who will say, here are some new spending programs. And again, that I think is a continuing problem that is important in this election.
Martin Feldstein, we've got 20 seconds here. Tough prognosis you're giving us today. What's your advice to the ordinary American family out there listening to this and thinking to themselves, what the heck do we do now?
They have to protect themselves by doing what that first caller did and paying down debt, reducing their interest exposure, and recognizing that the increased prices of oil and food are not going to go away.
Save yourselves, says Martin Feldstein, Professor Feldsteiner of Harvard University, and much more. We're very grateful to you for your time. Thank you very much for being with us
here
today.
Good being with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.